Well, now to the Brisbane writer Ashley Hay, who had great success with her previous novel, The Railwayman's Wife. Her new one is called 100 Small Lessons, and it centres on an old weatherboard house in suburban Brisbane and the two women who've called it home. The first is Elsie Gormley, an 89-year-old widow who lived in the house for 60 years from the day it was built. And the other is Lucy Kiss, who has found herself with a husband, a toddler and a mortgage, all in rapid succession. As the novel unfolds, these two women discover that time and place can both be very fluid. Cassie McCullough is talking to Ashley Hay, who starts with a reading from the opening of 100 Small Lessons. Elsie has had a fall. She's lying on the living room floor, listening to the house.
They'd had a long chat, Elsie Gormley, in this house, more than 60 years of it. It had witnessed all her tempers, all her moods, and usually improved them. It held her voice, her husband's, her children's, and now their children's in turn. Echoes and repetitions lodged in and around the skirting boards, around the window frames, like those pale motes of dust that had wedged at the edge of the kitchen floor. Reverb, one of Don's young boys had told her. Imagine it like this, Nan, layers of echoes arranged to make it sound like you're in a great big space. She swiped her fingers now against the thick green carpet. Yes, she could almost hear it. All those voices, all those years. It was lunchtime and then afternoon, and as the sun sank lower, she wondered how cold it might get there on the floor overnight. She was 89 years old and her bones were brittle and tired. The neighbours came then, one to the front door, one to the back. Elsie, they called, are you there, love? Are you right? She lay still, wondering if she could turn her head far enough to see the fiery clouds of the sunset through the windows at the front of the house.
Ashley Hay, welcome to Books and Arts.
Thank you.
Now, this novel tells the story of two women, one elderly and one a young mother. But it also tells the story of Brisbane and a city and its suburbs. Brisbane's your home now. Did you intentionally set out to write about place?
No, I didn't. But I think I always do, in a way. I moved to Brisbane about 9 years ago now, and it's been just lovely getting to know it. It's got a really different landscape to Sydney, where I'd lived for a long time before that, and to the south coast of New South Wales, where I grew up. And I think when I started imagining 100 Small Lessons, the place that I had in mind was a specific house, and the rest of Brisbane sort of came in around that. Brisbane's got a very different and sort of forceful weather, I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, the Brisbane that you describe seems to be as much a place as a state of being and one entwined with forces of nature, the weather, the floods, the trees and the leaves and the flowers. And I guess that's what you're describing, that experience.
Yes. When we moved up to Brisbane, the first big piece of journalism that I wrote was for the Griffith Review, and it was for an issue that they were putting together about Queensland, and it was about conservation and conservation ecology. And I'm really grateful to Julianne Schultz for commissioning that piece, because it meant that I arrived in this new place. I arrived in a new backyard looking at what was there much more consciously, I think, than I might have otherwise. And I also arrived in a place and started having these conversations with ecologists and biologists and policymakers about this just enormous piece of Australia, Queensland, about which I didn't know that much. So the landscape and the elements of the landscape, the plants, the insects, the climate, all of these things really pressed in on me in a very direct way from the moment we arrived.
Very, very visceral the way you describe it.
Thank you.
There's also a sense that time and place and memory are all bound together somehow, that things that have happened in a place leave a mark and that there are traces and resonances still present long after they might seem to have disappeared. And this really becomes apparent in the connection between the two women, Elsie and Lucy. Tell us firstly about 89-year-old Elsie Veronica Gormley, who we heard you describing in that section you read us.
Well, Elsie is an elderly lady who has lived in her home for more than 60 years. She's raised her two children there. Her husband has died a long time before, and when we meet Elsie at the beginning of the book, she's fallen in her house, and she doesn't know, but it's the last time that she'll be in her house. She's, you know, then taken off to hospital, and from hospital she goes off to a kind of a nursing home, and the house is sold. And Elsie, I love Elsie. I think she's she's the character of all the characters I've ever had the kind of privilege of imagining and working with. Elsie really gets me. I loved the idea of this big span of life, the ups and downs of life, the little bits and pieces of it all taking place in this one small weatherboard house. And I loved the idea of some of that experience transmitting to the next people who come in to make their family in that home.
We mentioned nature earlier on, and also Elsie's husband, long dead actually, Clem. Mm, mm. He seems to have been waging a war against nature in a way, keeping the garden meticulously tidy and trimming things and pruning things to within an inch of their life. Is that what you were doing there?
Yes, and I think it is one of the things that fascinated me about houses that you would see in Brisbane. So my sense of Brisbane when we moved up here was it was this incredibly rich, alive, almost rapacious landscape where you could almost literally see things growing in front of your eyes. There's a line somewhere in the book about the idea of waking up one night and finding that plants had grown in through the window, like in Where the Wild yes. Things Are. And I was perfectly prepared for that to happen, that sort of subtropical fecundity somehow. But what also fascinated me was walking around the suburbs where we came to live, there would be these blocks of land that were absolutely pristine. Like some of them literally only had grass and a house, not a single tree. Or there might be one tree at the back, one tree at the front, or maybe just a veggie garden and a bit of a shrub. And I started to think about why you would be doing that, and whether it was about taming nature or just sort of marking out your space in a really obvious way. And it also reminded me that my grandparents, who lived nowhere near Brisbane, they didn't have any trees planted on their front lawn. And I remembered being a kid and asking my grandmother why this was the case. And she just said, oh, your grandfather doesn't like mowing around them. And it was as simple as that. And so I sort of gave that to Clem as well.
This difference between Clem and Elsie sort of opens up a gulf that's in their relationship, and we learn more about that as the novel continues. And also it seems to be reflected in the relationship between the younger couple, Lucy and Ben. Is this kind of what you're writing about, that the idea that there can be these vast gulfs in a relationship or inside a home, which from the outside looks warm and loving and intimate?
I think it is, but also that those vast gulfs aren't necessarily dangerous. I mean, some of them cause conflict, and some of them make things rub up against each other the wrong way. But also some of them are just life, you know, that there are always things that we can never know about our partners or our children, no matter how close we are to them. There are always things that we will see through one prism and our partner might see through another prism. There are all these sort of little fissures and cracks, but they're not necessarily the end of the world, if you know what I mean. Mm. And sometimes you work them out, and sometimes you sort of reconcile them. Sometimes you kind of paper over them and pretend they're not there. Sometimes perhaps you never even notice. But one of the things that I was interested in doing with the novel was looking at these little moments of life and the way they could flow on, the way that the smallest thing might have an impact that would turn up 40 years later or 60 years later, the way we put out all these little sparks and pulses, and it might be decades before we see the consequence of that or the gift or result of all of those things.
Mm. You've really picked up on a great tension that's existing, I think, about the home, the mortgage, the great Australian dream, and this being something that we desperately crave, but also this immense shackling weight that drags our relationships down. And there is this sort of quiet desperation about the home and the mortgage.
Well, it's such a big thing to do, isn't it? It's, you know, it's kind of an overwhelming thing to take on. I hadn't ever owned a home until we came up here. And I think, you know, my husband and I were kind of dedicated renters, and that felt great. And one of the things about actually buying a house was I'd never understood, you know, you have all those blasé conversations about picture hooks and vegetable gardens and things that you'd like to do and maybe can't. But it allows you to sort of drill yourself into a house in a different way, I guess, to sort of attach to it or shape it somehow. And by the same token, I think because I do write a lot about place and I am kind of conscious of how places work on us, it works in reverse as well, that the house then starts to shape you in a sense. And that's a really crucial thing for Elsie and Lucy in 100 Small Lessons. They are sort of affecting each other through the membrane of the house in a way. They're haunting each other with both of them being alive, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
And I was sort of really fascinated by that process, and by the process, I guess, of a house that had just one family live in it for, you know, all the time since it was brand spanking new, and then another family in a completely different era, a completely different world, sort of coming in to start the whole cycle again.
It's a massive psychic resonance that a house can have with a history like that, and it's clear that it impacts on Lucy. Tell us more about her. She's young, and they've bought this house. They've got the young boy, Tom. And as Ben jokes, you know, they've sort of done all this other stuff and now they're embarking on the great Australian dream, the kid and the house and the mortgage, which, you know, had become very real very quickly. But it's a kind of nervous joke from his side. Tell us more about their relationship.
Yes, they are exactly all of those things. And I think what is most interesting about them is they're doing what lots of people are doing, which is they've had a relationship for quite some time. They've had a relationship as two adults with work that they like and a pretty mobile lifestyle.
Yeah.
And suddenly there are three of them. And they're in this place. And this place is the place where Ben's own childhood has come from, has sort of sprung from. Not the literal house, but Brisbane, the city. Yeah, I guess it is all of those things that change fantastically and perhaps a little more unexpectedly when there are three of you instead of two of you, all the stuff that you're probably supposed to think about before there are three of you, and I'm not sure that many people do. And the thing that really resonated with me for Lucy, or the thing that I was interested in exploring through her, was Lucy arrives in Brisbane with a young child, and as you say, you know, they kind of get here and get this house and it's this whole new thing. But it made me think about the way arriving in motherhood is like coming to a new place as well. You know, motherhood is essentially another land that you have to learn how to navigate. And Lucy makes hard work of it, I think, for lots of reasons. But it just seemed like this sense of arrival, this sense of literally arriving in a new geography, gave me a really interesting metaphor to think about in terms of everything that is to do with becoming a mother.
Mm-hmm.
Lucy stood on the deck under a Christopher Robin umbrella, holding Tom high. The park had a deep layer of water across its car park now, and a curtain of water obscured its grass. What do you think, Tom? Will Dad have to sail to work in an umbrella, like Winnie the Pooh? Tom chuckled and squirmed, and Lucy squeezed him before she set him down. Should we worry? She asked Ben. She nodded at the heavy sheet of rain. You can't worry about everything, Lou. All the warnings are for flash floods, and that's nothing to do with us here. Then what is? He shrugged again. A river flood, I guess. Like 74? Like 74. And will that happen again this time? I don't know. They're releasing water upstream, so I don't think so. I'll make some calls when I get to work. He kissed the top of her head, their umbrellas butting and showering spray. You don't want something else to worry about, do you? He smiled then and he rubbed his hand across her back. Come on, Lou, it's fine. It's all fine.
Heavens, that rain's so realistic, I find myself looking up and wondering if there's a hole in the roof. Ashley Hay there, reading from her latest novel, 100 Small Lessons, and it's published by Allen & Unwin. And that book follows the success of Ashley's second novel, The Railwayman's Wife, which won the prestigious Colin Roderick Award. A lot of very marvellous people have won the Colin Roderick Award, and also the People's Choice at the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards. And Ashley was speaking there to Cassie McCullough.